It's Mark Brenne on CFAX 1070.
Have you been around? Have you done your share of coming down on different things that people do?
4:35, 25 minutes before 5, news release from the Raincoast Conservation Foundation. It reads thusly: the federal government's decision to approve the Trans Mountain Pipeline Project is the wrong choice for endangered killer whales and for the climate emergency. The project will not go ahead without a fight. Let's bring in Misty McDuffie, Wild Salmon Program Director at the Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Hi, Misty.
Hi, Mark.
What do you mean the project will not go ahead without a fight?
Well, that we will continue to defend the southern resident killer whales that rely on the critical habitat in the Salish Sea, which is the shipping route for these tankers.
Okay, so what could you do? Are we talking about legal fights? Are we talking about something else, protests and the like?
Well, I think in terms of our options, what one of the things that we're looking at, of course, is to continue to pursue this legally. And, it's been a long legal road with southern resident killer whales. We first had to establish the components of their critical habitat, including, you know, the acoustic quality, the chemical, the biological, all those attributes of critical habitat, and then successfully arguing the last time the NEB made a decision and the federal government made a decision. So that will likely that'll be in the courts again. But we're specifically examining what that strategy would look like.
I know some people who are listening now are saying, "Look, Misty, we've been down this road for 5, 6, 7, almost 10 years now. There's been fight after fight after fight. There continues to be court cases involving the Trans Mountain Pipeline. The horse is out of the barn for the second time. The fight is over. Let it go." How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, it continues to be a bad idea, and the more that that time advances, the worse this idea becomes. And our focus has always been on southern resident killer whales, but increasingly it's these other aspects as well, including climate change. But the point that we continue to make is that, and this is I think where we got a different response from the National Energy Board in the second round than we had in the first round. In the second round, what the National Energy Board said was that this project can't go ahead without these significant adverse effects to southern resident killer whales, and that the federal government needed to make, that it was a trade-off, so that if the federal government wants to go ahead with this project, that it has this cost to the whales themselves. And then it also acknowledged even First Nations connection to their cultural connection to these whales. So, and as many others know, there are, that's just one aspect of this project. So, I think that many coastal British Columbians and many Canadians would agree that these are not acceptable costs.
I got to tell you, though, living out in Ottawa and Toronto for most of my life, I wouldn't know a killer whale if it hit me right in the head. If a killer whale walked up on me on Yonge Street, I wouldn't know it was a killer whale. I don't know. I mean, you know what I'm trying to get at. I'm not trying to say that people out east don't know what an orca looks like, but it's not top of mind out there. So I'm wondering if this is something that just resonates here. Don't get me wrong, I love the killer whales. I'm not trying to diminish their value, their importance and in our culture. But I'm just saying, Canada-wide, I'm wondering if it resonates past our borders at British Columbia.
Well, I think that killer whales are just the tip of the iceberg. They're just a really strong example of how our footprint, and in this case locally in the Salish Sea, comes at a cost to the survival of many other species. And we're seeing that, more and more. Like, we just have to look to the East Coast also to see that they're having their own crisis with whales. So whales are in crisis on each coast. In the north, we know it to be different animals. So it doesn't really matter where we look and what species we want to hold up. everybody everywhere has these examples. People that live back east are seeing the disappearance of a jay that has always, again, been iconic to those areas, again, due to climate change. So I think the awareness that we can't continue to go down the road that we've been going down is in many people's awareness now, and that as this fragile network of diversity is unraveling, that ultimately our own lives are connected to that. So species can't blink out, and the ecosystem can't unravel without having implications for humans. So whether we want to look at this from a utilitarian perspective of what befalls these species befalls us, or whether we want to say that the quality of life is compromised without having the attributes of the natural world around us. You know, depending on, you know, where you want to come from this, it really all comes down to the same place. And killer whales here are just the example of that unraveling.
Karen Ristin with Living Ocean Society says this. She says, it's inconceivable that the Salish Sea could withstand 800 additional tanker transits per year. That number actually is in doubt, whether it's going to be actually 800 additional tanker transits per year. But anyways, what she goes on to say is, plus associated escort tugboat traffic, without a substantial increase in risk to marine life from ship strikes and oil spills. We know a lot about oil spills and the dangers that could happen if just one were to happen. It'd be awful. What about ship strikes? How often does a killer whale get hit by a ship?
Ship strikes with killer whales are a rare event, but what Karen didn't say in that is the noise, and that's why this project is, and the noise associated with it, it separates it from the risk of oil spills. So oil spills are a risk, and they're not just a risk to whales, they're a risk to many other species in the Salish Sea, to salmon, to many things. But that is a risk. That's a probability times a consequence. But the thing about noise is, and where those 800 transits come in, because in risk, what we're most concerned about is an outgoing laden tanker. But with noise, it doesn't matter whether that tanker is carrying oil or not. The noise generated from those transits, inbound and outbound, is a certainty. And what noise does, and the physical presence of the vessel, is it can reduce the communication space over which a whale can hear and be heard, and the sound that those vessels make can occur in the same frequencies as their calls and their echolocation. And then the physical presence of the vessel, if it's close to the whale, can change its behavior. And the way all of those three things come together is that they reduce the ability of the whale to successfully catch salmon. And because these whales are so dependent on salmon, and their crisis is largely driven by a lack of salmon, the noise and the disturbance work in the same way that taking away salmon does. It reduces the amount that they consume. So that's how, when we look at the details of the increase in tanker traffic. Right now, killer whales, when they're in their critical habitat in the Salish Sea, are in the presence of a vessel 85% of the time. And with this project, they will be in the presence of a vessel more than 92% of the time. And potentially, vessels will be a near continuous presence, to quote Trans Mountain.
Those are rather high percentages. When you say in the presence of, how close are you saying the killer whale is, or the boat rather, the ship would be to the killer whale? How close?
Right. So that's a good question. So it's generally about 800 meters is within the presence of. And that's a range where that noise and that presence can have an effect on that whale. And that's not just tankers, that's all vessels. And so we have to always remember that this is a cumulative problem. It's not just these you know, tankers. It's the fact that we've already crossed a line on the quality of critical habitat that these whales need to recover. And rather than step back from that line and implement recovery measures that can reduce noise and disturbance to try and improve their access to salmon, that can reduce the contaminant burden that they carry, this project takes us further down that road. And so when you further look at what this means is that if killer whales reduce their foraging efficiency in the presence of a vessel, and they move from 85% of the time to being in the presence of a vessel more than 90% of the time, there's an associated 16% reduction in their successful feeding.
You're the scientist and you study this, so you know, shame on me to say this, but I mean, that seems rather high to me that killer whales more than 80% of the time are within 800 meters of, that's less than a kilometer, of a ship.
Of a vessel. Yeah, so a vessel is everything from small boats, small private boats, to commercial whale watching boats.
But don't most of these vessels stay within the shipping lanes? And these killer whales are very smart. At some point, do they not determine where the shipping lanes are and they stay away from them?
So the important thing is that when we say vessel, we mean all types of traffic. So
yeah,
that's whale watching boats that are there to be with the whales, right? And up until last year, or this year, sorry, they could be 200 meters, within 200 meters from those whales.
Now it's 400 meters.
And now it's 400 meters.
Yeah.
So if you've got, and they're in the presence of whale-watching vessels when they're in the Salish Sea, up until, there may be some reduction in that this year, but when those whales enter the Salish Sea, there are whale-watching boats around them, used from morning until evening. So whale-watching vessels and other, private vessels that add on when they see commercial whale-watching vessels, that can be a strong component of that. And it can be ferries, it can be, other traffic, it's not just the ships. So it goes back to that piece about that it's cumulative. It's the fact that we need to walk away, dial this back, and not make this worse, and that this project makes this worse. And so, continuing to crunch those numbers, what we concluded was that the project had significant adverse effects, which was a substantial increase in the risk of extinction, and those effects couldn't be mitigated, and that's the important piece that where we get back into the legal piece is that under the Species at Risk Act, that the idea of SARA is that if you're considering a project that's going to have these significant adverse effects and you cannot mitigate those effects, then your project shouldn't proceed.
Got to hold you there, Misty. Sorry, just because of time. We'll come right back and continue our conversation. Hi, Bev. I see you on line one. I'm going to get to your call and others. 250-386-1161, *1070. When we come back for the news, traffic, and weather, I'm with Misty McDuffie. She's the Wild Salmon Program Director at the Raincoast Conservation Foundation.
Now, Mark Brenne on CFAX 1070.
4:51, 9 minutes before 5, we are with Misty McDuffie, Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Misty, you want to go right to the phone lines because I got a whole bunch of phone calls and lots of texts. Bev, thanks for listening and calling. Go ahead, Bev.
Yeah, thank you, good afternoon to your guest. An interesting number of points that she raised in regards to this whole matter of the approval of the pipeline. Definitely will increase the number of ships in the Salish and in the Straits of Juan de Fuca. But, I do recognize you did mention the fact that it's not only the tankers. We literally have hundreds and hundreds of vessels of every type, already tankers, cargo vessels, military vessels,
cruise
submarines.
Ships.
We have ships of every shape and size plying those waters now. The addition of the tankers that will transport the oil to outside markets to provide much increased benefits to the Canadian economy are relatively few compared to the total that are now plying the waters. And in fact, as the population grows, there will be more and more and more ships supplying goods and services and recreation to the population. So that's in regards to the ships. Now, I just wanted to get into the killer whale population themselves. My understanding is that over the last 60 years, the killer whale population, the resident killer whale population, has fluctuated between as low as 60 animals and as high as 95 animals. And now we're at about 75. So we're sort of in the middle, probably towards the higher end of the spectrum of numbers. And so is it an absolute dire emergency? These words like emergency and crisis are continuously bandied about, probably out of context to the real situation.
Well, let's find out from Misty. And I'm wondering if it's not just the quantity, but the quality. I'm wondering about the health of those 75. Misty?
Yeah, no, it's your caller raises a good point. So when we look at the last 60 years or so, and we know that they were down below 70 animals, we always have to remember the context of how we got there. So these whales were victim of the aquarium trade. So in southern British Columbia and Washington waters, 48 to 50 of the southern resident whales were removed from these waters and were either sold to aquariums or died in the process. And prior to that, they were also victims of fisheries conflicts. So up until the early 70s, about 25% of the whales that they removed for the aquarium trade had bullet wounds in them. So, you know, there was a lot of conflict with humans up until then that put them to that point. Some of the genetic estimates suggest that it was a population somewhere between 150 to 200. So never a big population, but a more robust population than there is now. And those numbers and those higher numbers would have allowed a population to weather the loss of individuals and be able to absorb losses that a smaller, more vulnerable, a smaller population just can't. And so, after the aquarium trade and the Marine Mammal Act came into play, we did see the population start to recover. And as your caller said, it made it almost up to about 100 individuals. And then, and then things changed. And whether that's the lost generation that the result of the aquarium trade, whether that's a declining quality in the Salish Sea, whether that of critical habitat, whether that's starting to reflect the declines in salmon abundance, those numbers started to decline. And the reason that everybody is so concerned now is because there are there's very few breeding females, and there's only really been two males that have sired.
So a lot of inbreeding going on here.
Well, there's been two males that have sired 50% of the calves since about 2004. So there are these concerns for what's called inbreeding depression and the loss of diversity and the concern for lower survival when you start to see inbreeding. So we're in this very precarious state where, and the other piece is that killer whale culture is such that you have individuals within the population that may not be contributing to the reproductive growth of that population, but the presence of older whales, especially females, increases the survival of other whales, and there's this cultural shared learning that goes on, and so all the other whales become really important to either the culture or the diversity or the reproductive potential of the population. And so now the loss of any individual has what we call population level consequences. And that's where we're at now with this population is that that the breeding females, the older females, the young whales, they're all important and to kind of start to, if we're going to get out of this hole.
Listen, Misty, are you able to stay with us for a little bit longer? Because I'm up against the clock right now.
Sure.
And I got a whole ton of calls here.
Sure.
Okay, let's do this. Let's break for the news, and we'll come right back, and we'll continue. Bernice, you'll be up first when we come back. Misty McDuffie, Wild Salmon Program Director with the Raincoast Conservation Foundation.
Now, Mark Brenne on CFAX 1070.
5:07, as we drive home together, let's continue our conversation with Misty McDuffie with the Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Misty says the federal government blew it with yesterday's decision to green light the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. She says the added oil tankers in the waters off BC's coast are going to make it even more difficult for our southern resident killer whales to seek out, find, and eat the salmon they need. Misty, lots of phone calls. I'd like to go right to it. Bernice, thank you so much for listening and for waiting as long as you have. Go ahead, Bernice.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have three questions, and then I'll hang up and wait for the answers.
Great.
Okay, one, are you even considering Roberts Bank to protest them as well? Two, have you talked with Canada, specifically DFO, and asking them why are they, you know, why haven't they been managing this killer whale issue much earlier, 15, 20 years ago, and instead of starting in the middle with the Chinook, start with the plankton, the herrings, all the way up. And three, I don't know if you have the answer to this, but when people speak about standing up for the First Nation people, when they're protesting things, do they actually go talk to them or just a few and then speak for everybody? So those are my questions. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Bernice. Let's start with the third one. What kind of consultations have you had with First Nations?
So we absolutely do not speak for First Nations. And when I referenced them in the beginning, all I referenced was the fact that the NEB concluded that the implications from the impact to killer whales would also have cultural effects for First Nations. So even though we work with First Nations on different projects, absolutely we don't speak for them. So it's a good point.
Second question was Department of Fisheries and Oceans. In your estimation, why haven't they done a little bit more to manage the what's going on with the southern resident killer whales?
Yeah, that's a really great question because they've been endangered since 2003 when they were first listed under SARA. Since then, we've lost, you know, we've seen 50 whale deaths over that period of time, and we've also seen the decline in Chinook. And I completely agree that despite the pressure that we've been trying to place on DFO over these years for action, which included having to go to court just to get them to recognize the attributes of critical habitat, and then you know, they were delayed on their recovery plans and their action plans and continually dragging their feet and us trying to pull them along. So had we made different decisions quite some time ago, we may not be in this situation.
The first question, I'm hoping you can help me out on. Bernice, I thought she said Robert Spank,
and she's talking about the expansion, the proposed expansion at Terminal 2, and the increase in shipping that brings to the Salish Sea, which is more than Trans Mountain. And she's absolutely right. And we are interveners in that process. We actually just finished going through hearings about the expansion at Roberts Bank and the implications for whales, which is exactly. There are other implications from Roberts Bank that we're also concerned about, the barriers to salmon migration and the loss of habitat within the Fraser Estuary. But the implications for southern residents are the same as this project. It's an increase in shipping. It's an increase in the presence of those vessels. It's more noise in the Salish Sea. It's moving in the wrong direction. So she raises a really good point.
I have to, you're going to laugh at this. I did the Google on Roberts Bank, but I did Robert Spank. I thought it was some law case, some lawsuit that some precedent was set or something. So I'm putting down Robert Spank, and I'm going, what the heck is Roberts Bank?
Terminal 2.
Got you. Okay. A text message wants to know, where does Raincoast get its funding?
So various sources. Most of our funding is coming from individual donors within Canada. We also get our second. It's probably more like 50-50. And second would be Canadian foundations, and then third would be individuals and foundations within the U.S. and more globally.
John writes, all whale-watching boats should be sailboats in an effort to reduce noise around the killer whales so they can hear the echo from their food targets. What do you think of that? That'd be nice.
I, you know, what he's doing.
I don't know if they're going to be able to keep. I don't think they're keep up with the whales.
I don't think they could keep up.
Right.
But he's, you know, he raises the point that this close proximity vessels, you know, has this, you know, it's the three pathways, the physical presence that can change their behavior. If they, and when we say that change in the behavior, it's an activity state. Say that they move from feeding to traveling or from resting to traveling. So from whatever they were doing, the proximity of that vessel can change their behavior. And then the reduced communication space and the potential to mask those echolocation and other calls. So it's absolutely a concern at that close proximity. I'd say DFO has recognized that in the move now to increase that distance to 400 meters.
Got a text message, and it's a good one. It's short and quick. I'll paraphrase it. Is this organization also fighting cruise ships as well? Are you concerned?
No.
I mean, you talked about all the boats, and, you know, you talked about the ferries and all kinds of pleasure craft, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Boy, oh, boy, we got a lot of cruise ships that come in here, 242 or something like that visits every year just to Victoria.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've set your sights on?
So it raises the issue of, so what do we do, even though that we're, specifically opposing these big projects that significantly increase shipping, what about all of the other vessels? What about the ferries, like you just said? What about all the private vessels and the cruise ships? And so what we have to do over time, and this is where, you know, Transport Canada is, you know, slowly making some progress there, but they have now recognized, and the technology exists to make ships much quieter. The military have had it for a long time. But what has to happen is that Canada needs to say that if you are a foreign vessel and you're going to transit through Canadian waters, you have got to meet standards for vessel quieting technology. So that means you've got to do proper maintenance, and it means that you've got to start implementing whether it's propellers, engines, all of the ways that we can quiet those ships. That has to come through regulation, and it needs to be implemented to all vessels that are going to move through.
And you say that technology exists for the military, for example, that would make a difference?
Yeah, it gets into the sources of noise, right? Why do ships make so much noise? And so that's a combination of the engine, and it's a combination of the cavitation of the propeller. And where the military has made significant advances is in that cavitation piece, which is causing most of that broadband noise. And they have ways to change that, to slow down that the speed of the rotation, to change the blades, the angles of the propeller, to do a lot of things to reduce cavitation and also to quieten those engines. So it's never been forced. It's never been an issue. So we've always designed ships to be, you know, as economically as we could. But if the goal is to make the ship quieter, the technology is there, and it just needs to be mandated.
Well, that seems to me to be probably the answer to this. I'm not suggesting it's going to be easy to have it done. You see some of the rust buckets that come in from overseas that go through our waters, but it's not like we're going to stop shipping. That's not going to stop. So I think that's the only solution. But Misty, I got to hold it there. I'm late for the news, and I got my next guest is waiting on the other line. Misty, thank you so much for spending the time today. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving the time to this issue.
It's an important one. Thank you.